and speak to the political editor of the Financial Times, George Parker. Morning again, George.
Morning.
In the hours after yesterday's meeting, the reaction from London seemed to be less enthusiastic, but most of the front pages of newspapers in Britain this morning do seem to be quite positive. You yourself are posing the question over a picture of a handshake between Leo Varadkar and Boris Johnson. Not exactly Reykjavik 1986, but was the Thornton Manor meeting a turning point? Do you think it was?
Well, we're going to find out, as Tony's just been describing, a bit later today when the details of this proposal start to leak out. But you're right. I mean, we didn't hear at all from Boris Johnson on the record. The Taoiseach gave a press conference yesterday and, as you say, sounded very positive. Boris Johnson said nothing. The official word out of Downing Street has been nothing at all, really. DUP, as far as I can tell, haven't been briefed. The Cabinet, the UK Cabinet, hasn't been briefed. So all we can do is read the mood music. And what I can say is, talking to people around Boris Johnson yesterday, there was a real sense that that something had changed. There was sort of a note of optimism and almost excitement in their voices, which is something you don't normally associate with officials after sitting through a Brexit meeting. So, yeah, there's a feeling that something's moved, but at the moment we don't know exactly what.
Will we know today, if Steve Barclay is putting these proposals to Michel Barnier, will they become either public or more public?
I think they will become more public, as Tony was saying, that once Mr. Barnier has briefed 27 EU ambassadors from each of the member states, that's normally a forum which is pretty leaky. Once 27 countries know what's in the proposal, things start to leak out. And I would be surprised if the UK government doesn't then want to start sort of managing the information flow as well, because the danger from Boris Johnson's point of view, of course, is if he's made some significant concessions on Northern Ireland and the customs question, there's a danger that that is then rejected by the DUP. And if the DUP start to reject the proposals, there's a danger he then starts to lose the hardline Eurosceptics in his own party. So there's, if he's made the concessions that we've been speculating on, there's an awful lot of internal political management to be done back at Westminster.
A customs halfway house, a case of, I can't believe it's not a customs union, but some way of avoiding border checks on this island. Do you think that's something he could get through the House of Commons?
It's going to be difficult, for sure, because, you know, he's made a big thing about Northern Ireland leaving the EU customs union, the EU at the same time as the rest of the UK. But I think you heard there from Tony's explanation that there is, that this issue is so complicated and so much beyond the understanding of most ordinary people, that it's the kind of thing that bureaucrats and lawyers working in Brussels are quite able to fudge. So no doubt it won't be called a customs union, whatever applies to Northern Ireland at the end of this process. It certainly won't be called a backstop. And the objective really between now and next week's summit is to blur the lines so that nobody can really work out who's won or lost. I think the one thing that is very likely at the end of this process is that whatever new arrangement comes out, there won't be a unionist or DUP veto on it, which seems to be a feature of the initial British proposal. I think the British government's very aware of the need to make it this a cross-community project in Northern Ireland. But at the end of the day, if Northern Ireland somehow remains part of the EU customs union, that's not a bad outcome economically for Northern Ireland, as you know. Northern Ireland business and farmers and virtually every aspect of the community and the population at large would actually love it, because they'd have one foot in the EU single market, one foot in the UK market, and they become a top destination for inward investment.
It's been a long week. It's very hard to keep track of where this process has gone all week. It started with a lot of negativity and a lot of who was going to win the blame game. And in the middle of all of that, as you mentioned, Northern Ireland staying in a customs union, or indeed the entire of the UK staying in its own customs union separate from the EU, seemed to be emerging as a red line for Boris Johnson. We know why it was important to unionists to keep an integrity within the UK. Why is it important to Boris Johnson?
I think it's much less important to Boris Johnson, other than the fact that he has always needed those 10 DUP votes in the House of Commons, and with them, the support of Tory Eurosceptic MPs as well. So I think that's the bottom line for Boris Johnson, is to be able to get something through the House of Commons. And the other big, powerful driver of all this, despite all the noise, and probably the noise reflects it, is that Boris Johnson needs a deal. Boris Johnson needs a deal before he has a British general election, because he knows that if he goes to the country having not delivered Brexit, do or die, dead in a ditch, he will face a heavy toll when Britain finally gets to vote. So he needs the deal. The EU knows he needs a deal. And you can see the dynamic of a negotiation where Boris Johnson and his allies are shouting quite loudly, but at the same time quietly negotiating as they were yesterday behind the scenes. And the DUP will be on red alert for any sign of betrayal by Mr. Johnson in the interest of his own, in saving his own political skin.
George, thank you as ever. That's George Barker, political editor at the Financial Times. We'll have more on Brexit later in the programme, 7:25.